Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 271, Basutoland Gun War, Gold Coast and Ottoman Empire. The British had instigated a war in the Transvaal, which fired off in early 1881, but they had already ignited another flashpoint in Basutoland. This was a fascinating conflict, and it has modern overtones. For the new British government of Sir William Gladstone, the fact they had stimulated a simultaneous slew of conflicts in South Africa was more than irksome. It was expensive and ill-timed. While Britain was dealing with a humiliating setback against the Boers, it was struggling to enforce authority in Basutoland, highlighting how imperial control was both stretched and inconsistent in the region. Following Basutoland's transformation into a British dominion in March 1868, it became the target of rapid westernization efforts by the Cape Colony administration. By 1879, the Cape Parliament had extended the Peace Preservation Act to Basutoland, with the aim of disarming the people of the territory. This did not go down well. Guns, like horses, were of immense significance in Basutu society. Most Basutu who worked on the Kimberley diamond fields bought both muskets and later rifles, as well as Boer ponies and other horses, before making their way home. What was going on in the minds of the Cape Colony and those in the Imperial Colonial Office? It's very important to our story to understand global events of the time. For decades, all of the European governments concerned with the coast of Africa, both east and west, had come tacitly to agreements not to allow quarrels of their respective traders and officials to become occasions for empire. That was the theory. The ministries in both Paris and London wanted nothing more than to continue their gentlemen's agreement, although each suspected the other of wanting to break it. Napoleon III had earlier nourished a few sporadic projects for Africa expansion, but the catastrophe of the Franco-Prussian War of 1870 had slowed them down. The French Third Republic pulled out of the Ivory Coast and was considering renouncing all options in Dahomey. It wanted to leave Gabon as well as the Congo. But Senegal was another matter. The French colonial government in Dakar had developed a local expansive program derived mainly from the army's influence rather than pure economics. There were plans to build a major railway line to the upper Niger River, which would link Senegal to Niger. The French rulers of Senegal were expanding eastwards as well as southwards and had begun to encircle Gambia. All of these moves in Africa must be recognized as part of our story here in South Africa. To Colonial Secretary Lord Kimberley, French expansion plans were disturbing. It meant Sierra Leone and the Gambia would lose their hinterlands, and the British would be trapped on the African west coast, and in the minds of the Colonial Office, forever economically stunted. They wanted to tap the markets and commodities further inland. To sort out any misunderstanding with the French, the British cabinet proposed that the frontier between the African Gold Coast and a French settlement known as Assigny on the Ivory Coast, Côte d'Ivoire, be delimited. Borders set. These days, it is known as Assigny Mafia, a popular high-end tourist destination about 80 kilometers east of Abidjan. The British also suggested another line north of Sierra Leone should be demarcated following a standstill agreement. The French agreed. They were more interested in Tunisia and keeping an eye on what London was up to in Egypt. For the British, the other really important part of Africa, they wanted to be free of French interference with the deltas of both the Congo and Niger. Since 1880, French firm Société Française de l'Afrique Équatoriale had established in the oil rivers. That was the European name for a maze of creeks and estuaries in the Niger Delta or Niger Delta in what is now southern Nigeria. The oil rivers were not named for petroleum, no, but for the palm oil trade that dominated the delta in the 19th century, centered on almost mythical places like Boni, Brass, Opobo, and Old Calabar. In the late 1870s, the region had become one of the most important export zones in West Africa because Britain's industrial economy needed huge quantities of palm oil for soap making and candles and machine lubrication. What made the region interesting historically was that African merchant states and chiefs still controlled this trade. Rulers like Jaja of Opobo, the Efik merchants in Calabar, and the Boni trading houses. They acted as African middlemen between the interior and European coastal firms, becoming extremely wealthy and politically powerful. By 1880, this commercial rivalry fed directly into imperial expansion as Britain struggled to secure the trade routes from their French and German rivals. Out of interest, the trading routes established by 19th century chiefs became the same corridors used for the first oil pipelines and shipping lanes. The families who understood these choke points were the first to be positioned for the oil boom of the 1970s. But 100 years earlier, French trading posts were competing directly with British firms like John Holt and the United African Company. That French presence is one of the reasons Britain moved quickly in the 1880s to formalize control of the Delta. This is very much part of the wider scramble for Africa story. Trade first, then flags, treaties, and eventually protectorates. Globally speaking, the main British nightmare was the Russian advance towards the Dardanelles, Turkey, Persia, India, China. So the British maintained a navy allied with Turkish armies in the Near East to protect the Indian route through the Suez against the Russians. London, allied with the Ottoman Sultan Abdul Hamid II, who ruled Greater Turkey, and his subordinate Khedive Ismail of Egypt. They were being schmoozed as reliable vassals who served Britain's financial and imperial interests. Britain could avoid seizing territory directly, which would have been expensive and politically ruinous. No boots on the ground, just deploy the one-step-away approach via their navy, it was thought. The Ottoman Sultan Abdul Hamid II, however, had been borrowing heavily from the English and even more from the French. While his revenues fell short of expenditure and debt mounted, so he raised land tax. Christians in Bosnia and Herzegovina revolted against Turkish rule. More loans defaulted, and the Sultan, and therefore the Turkish Ottomans, went bankrupt. In Egypt, Khedive Ismail was also borrowing like crazy. His expenditure outran his income. Cairo was living loan to loan. Khedive Ismail had attempted to modernize Egypt. It was he who supported the hugely expensive construction of the Suez Canal. He also built 16 sugar factories, then developed the Ibrahimia Canal to support agriculture. So Egypt's national debt grew from £7 million to £100 million by 1876. And as the risk rose, lenders increased interest rates, and like the Turkish model, Khedive Ismail tried to squeeze more money out of the taxpayer. When the lending spigot was shut off in the late 1870s, both France and Britain pressurized the Ottoman Sultan Abdul Hamid II to replace Khedive Ismail with his son Tufik Pasha in Egypt. By then, the Ottomans owed £200 million to British and French banks. It was these banks who offered profligate loans which had helped to undermine the two regimes on which London and Paris's statesmen had built their systems of Mediterranean security, a case of financial capitalists undermining national interest. French and British debt commissioners were sent to manage Egyptian affairs. The foreign powers were dictating matters locally. In July 1880, a complicated law of liquidation was signed by 6 European powers: Britain, France, Austria, Italy, Germany. Britain and France held the majority of votes. This meant that 66% of Egypt's revenue was set aside to pay off debt. This did not sit well with the land-owning class nor the Egyptian army, not to mention the average Egyptian citizen. By replacing the Khedive with Tufik, they had shown up the Khedive to his people as a Christian puppet. So the danger of a general Ottoman collapse had set off the partition of Africa, and this changed what was going to happen in South Africa. You can imagine to the churning political minds in Downing Street how these global matters weighed on local officials. Tension had been growing for many years between the Basutu and the British. The southern corner of Basutoland was settled by the Maputi, led by Chief Morosi, who had been a tributary ruler of Moshweshwe. In 1869, he had agreed somewhat reluctantly to merge his territory with British Basutoland. In 1877, colonial authorities created the Kuting District, and Hamilton Hope was appointed there as magistrate. Morosi opposed this move, unhappy that his traditional power was being stripped away. In 1878, Cape Colonial authorities sent 80 African policemen and 700 Basutu warriors to arrest Morosi's son, Tota, for horse theft. After some negotiations, the dispute was resolved with the proviso that Magistrate Hope be replaced by another experienced Cape official, John Austin. Morosi didn't like him either, and the feeling was mutual. Eventually, Tota, the son, was apprehended but escaped and hid. Morosi refused to hand him over. During this time, Cape Colony Prime Minister Sir Gordon Sprigg had been growing more exasperated. He was a settler hardliner. The decision was made to forcibly disarm the Maputi, and King Letsi I of the Basutu was ordered to assist in the upcoming campaign against Morosi. These are mountainous areas, and both the Maputi and Basutu were well versed in the art of fighting on slopes and buttes and ravines and cliffsides. It took until the end of November before the Baputi defences on the hill known as Mount Morosi were overcome. The colonial troops were impressed by how well the Basutu cavalrymen fought on horseback, and in a strange way, that was their undoing. The colonial troops eventually summited Mount Morosi using ladders, but they could not have been able to achieve their mission without the extremely gifted Basutu cavalry. Morosi was killed. It was the savage act afterwards that drove a wedge between the Basutu and the colonial authorities. Morosi's body was decapitated and his severed head paraded in King Williamstown. Lesi was shocked. Is that what the settlers had in store for him too? Sprigg announced that the Kuting area would be confiscated by the Cape for white settlement. It wasn't going to be easy. Almost half the Basutu male population owned either a musket or a rifle. They had worked as labourers building railways in the Cape and on the diamond fields and returned home well-armed, riding freshly purchased horses. The Basutu were the best armed tribe in southern Africa and the best horsemen. For the men of the mountains, their firearms were an extension of both their cultural affiliation as well as their proof of manhood, in the same way firearms were for the Boers. A weapon of this sort is fundamental in Africa to defend oneself, family, homestead, and cattle when there's no police around, and official protection was extremely thin on the ground. Being prepared to fight off a raiding party was part of Basutu tradition. To be disarmed would have been both suicidal and an emasculation. In order to force the Basutu to do their bidding, colonial authorities used a blunt tool in the shed of oppression, oft deployed. It's called hut tax. In 1879, it was doubled to £1 per hut. Grumbling in Basutu land turned to a cacophony as other chiefs, notably Leratoli, the heir to the Basutu throne, voiced strong opposition. Leratoli and Letsi's brother Mosapo and his nephew Joel Mutapo challenged what they saw as Letsi's defeatist attitude, and Mosopo beefed up defences at Tabobusu. Rebel chiefs openly defied Magistrate John Austin, and white traders abandoned Basutuland as the situation worsened. Sprigg visited Letsi in an effort to convince the old chief to take the offer of a token fine and the handing in of Basutu guns. Negotiations failed because the other chiefs had been singularly unimpressed by the colonial troops during the Morosi gambit. They were not afraid of them. On the 13th of September 1880, a unit of around 220 Cape Mounted Rifles led by Lieutenant Colonel Frederick Carrington, rode into Basutuland from the west, the jump-off point, Viepena, in the Free State, heading towards the isolated British magistracy at Mafeking, not to be confused with Mafeking in the northwest. Sprigg sprang into action and mobilized the Cape's armed forces. While Brigadier General Charles Clark was ostensibly in charge, he relegated his responsibility to Major W.F.D. Cochrane and Carrington, commanding 2,000 men, including 400 Cape Mounted Rifles, 600 from Cape Mounted Yeomanry, 200 members of the Kimberley Mounted Horse, African Scouts, a few hundred from the Edinburgh Volunteer Guards, Prince Alfred Volunteer Guards, and First City Volunteer Rifles. 3,000 white and 1,000 African soldiers were backed up by 3 7-pounder mountain guns and 2 5.5-inch mortars. Opposing them in the Mafeking district were 9,000 mounted Basutu warriors. Another 14,000 were arrayed through the mountain kingdom, awaiting the Cape Army, some at Letsi's ancestral village of Moria. After heavy casualties taken by the Basutu in October, Leratori's men changed tactics. They had previously attacked in waves, in direct assaults, but quickly adopted Boer warfare, mobility, strategic attack, tactical retreat. All the colonial buildings in Maseru were burned down, and the Cape abandoned Mogalishoek and Kuting, the very districts they were planning to hand over to white settlers. The whole of Basutuland rebelled. The uprising spread out of the mountains and into the colony itself. In Griqualand East, the Griqua rose up. Magistrate Charles Brownlee fled from Kokstad, while behind him the rebels massacred Cape allies, the Amaklubi and Batra people. The Mpondomisa of Kumbu and Tsolo districts took up arms, as well as the Kwati and Amatimbu, who launched their own revolts around Timbuland. By late 1880, Cape authority in southern Africa was coming unstuck. Following the recall of Sir Bartle Frere, his temporary successor Henry Hugh Clifford made his position clear. The war in Basutuland was not one he intended to prosecute with imperial troops. Under the Cape system of responsible government, internal security was its own burden. As you know, the British were about to go to war with the Boers, and they also had their other imperial problems to deal with that I mentioned. Two British regiments remained in the region, but for war office purposes only. The Cape could not use them. Into the setting stepped Colonel Clark. In October, he moved out from Viepna with a composite column, roughly 1,000 cavalry, 600 infantry, 5 guns, and a long train of 40 wagons, aimed at relieving Mafeteng, which was still cut off. The garrison there resorted to sending messages to Clark in Greek instead of French, because most Basutu chiefs understood English and French, courtesy of French missionaries. On the 19th of October, Clark's force reached Kalabani, an isolated corps between Viepna and Mafeteng. Lerotoli had positioned about 3,000 men behind a ridge overlooking this road. The Cape Mounted Yeomanry's advance drew fire. Clark brought his artillery to bear and ordered a flanking movement. 200 men under Captain Dalgety pushed left towards the crest. The engagement turned abruptly. Before Dalgety's men could secure the high ground, Chief Seso led a charge of 300 axe-armed cavalry straight into them. Reinforcements from the 2nd Yeomanry stabilized the line, and a nearby village was taken, but the fighting exposed a critical weakness. The yeomanry lacked bayonets or swords and were poorly equipped for close combat. When the firing stopped, the Cape had lost 32 dead and 7 wounded. Basutu losses, 40 dead. Clark did reach Mafeteng, but his subsequent operations were limited to local counterinsurgency before he withdrew back toward the Cape by month's end. The broader initiative had not shifted. Through November and December, the pattern repeated. Colonel Carrington advanced along his line of communication, and in early December he was camped at Tsitsa's Neck, skirmishing along the approaches. A more substantial clash came on the 14th of January, 1881, when Colonel Charles Brabant advanced with a mixed force and 400 armed burghers from the Free State, and his 7-pounder guns. His immediate objective was Radimari. After burning the village, the burghers pushed on to Sipicheli, where Lerotoli was awaiting with a large army of 8,000. Also waiting there was Basutu chief Mama, who led 3,000 warriors, and they forced the burghers to retreat towards Brabant's main body. For a moment, the engagement threatened to collapse into a rout, but was held together by Boer fire discipline, carbines and artillery breaking the momentum of the attack. As Mama withdrew, Lerotoli's men opened sustained fire from the surrounding ridges, turning the fight into a contested withdrawal under pressure. Cape losses, 16 dead, 21 wounded. Basutu casualties were heavier, although not precisely recorded. Brabant then withdrew back to Tsitsa's Neck. Again, no lasting advantage. Across all of these months, the geography of control narrowed rather than expanded, and the Cape administration remained largely confined to Hlotse, Maseru, and eventually they returned to Mafeteng. In a kind of bizarre twist, Letsi I maintained a formal loyalty to the Cape, but his conduct suggested a more complex position. He confiscated land, accepted symbolic gestures from rebel allies, and, according to Basutu accounts, cultivated an appearance of weakness while he quietly encouraged continued resistance. Loyalist figures, such as Jonathan Molapo, even surrendered arms on his instruction, preserving internal authority should the balance of the war shift. Cape officials continued to interpret Letsi's behavior as loyal but ineffective, rather than strategically ambiguous, which is what he was up to. By January 1881, internal pressures intensified. The outbreak of the First Anglo-Boer War strained already limited resources. Cape war expenditure climbed to around £3 million. Fears that the Free State burghers might defect to support their Transvaal brethren to the north meant the Cape was forced to restrict additional Boer participation in Basutoland. Meanwhile, the Basutu sought a negotiated settlement. With the maize harvest approaching, the risk of famine began to outweigh the benefits of continued resistance. Through intermediaries, including Cape Parliament MP Jacobus Wilhelmus Sauer, they proposed terms, retention of their firearms and autonomous rule. The Cape rejected this outright, insisting on full disarmament, full submission. Talks broke down, but not without consequence. The 7-day armistice allowed the Basutu to harvest their crops. Newly appointed British High Commissioner Hercules Robinson continued to press for a negotiated end. By this stage, the outlines were clear. The Cape could still fight, but it could not compel on its own terms. By February 1881, the war had settled into a pattern of short advances and contained engagements, neither side able to impose a decisive outcome. Prime Minister Sprigg faced a sustained criticism in the Cape Parliament, with opposition figures moving toward a vote of no confidence. The Basutu gun war had become expensive, protracted, and inconclusive. High Commissioner Robinson arranged a meeting between Cape representatives and Chief Lerotoli outside Maseru in April 1881, and an armistice was agreed, but the central issue remained unresolved. Lerotoli would not agree to disarmament. 12 days later, on the 29th of April, Robinson imposed the settlement, the so-called award. Its terms reflected the limits that had become evident. The Basutu would retain their firearms, but under regulation. Each weapon had to be registered, and an annual fee paid of £1. In return, the Cape offered amnesty to the rebels and confirmed that Kuting would remain part of Basutoland. The Basutu, for their part, agreed to a collective fine of 5,000 cattle and compensation to loyalists and traders. The settlement did not resolve the underlying tension between autonomy and control. It formalized the compromise that had already taken shape on the ground. The Cape had not enforced disarmament, and the Basutu had not secured their full independence, but both sides accepted the framework that allowed the conflict to end. Cape losses in the war, 94 dead, 112 wounded. The Basutu never revealed their casualties, which were not counted, but is thought to number over 1,000. The political ground shifted quickly. On the 9th of May, 1881, Thomas Charles Scannon replaced John Gordon Sprigg as Prime Minister, and the appointment of Jacobus Wilhelmus Sauer signalled a more conciliatory approach to native affairs. Basutu rebels, however, continued to refuse to pay taxes and refused to register their firearms. They had retained their guns and prevented their land from falling into the hands of settlers. They had also thwarted Free State intentions of seizing their country. Much later, in 1910, when the Union of South Africa was decided, Basutoland remained on the outside, its status as a High Commission territory secured during this Basutoland gun war. Next, we're heading back to the Transvaal, to Volksrus, and the blood-soaked mountain called Majuba. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. You can sign up for the newsletter at desmondlatham.blog. Until next, Ret Labone.